Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, June 28th, 2001. In the fireside room this evening is John Marty. Today's session is titled Population Explosion and Sustainability of Life on Earth. Let's listen in.
I don't know if I had a clever title for this talk or not, but it had something to do with global population or population explosion. And can we sustain life on the planet given our wasteful and environmentally unsound habits mixed in with the explosion in population? And I guess the basic question that I don't think, it seems to me there's an answer that's not very pleasant to, and that is, are there limits to the number of people our planet can support before we destroy the planet and make it so it's uninhabitable for human beings? We certainly have environmental crises as a result of. Last year during the presidential campaign, there were certainly lots of major issues talked about, and I don't want to say any of them are less important than other ones, but taxes, Social Security, you name it, we talked about a whole lot of issues, but global population wasn't one of them. And is the issue important enough to talk about? Well, I remember in the early 70s, mid-70s, there was a lot of talk at the time when the world's population was about 4 billion people about how could we sustain our natural resources? Could we continue to grow the way we were, and the frightening population explosion, as it was called? Can we do something about that? Should we do something about that? The world is going to crash if we keep this exponential growth of population. And in October, I think it was, of 1999, less than 2 years ago, we reached 6 billion people. And I remember seeing little 2-inch stories in the newspaper the day it happened or the day before it happened that the world was hitting 6 billion people, but nothing more than that. No real debate. Presidential election a year later, nobody talked about it. I don't remember hearing a single mention about population and the problems related to it. So before getting into what the consequences of it are, and again, these are not issues that I as a state legislator particularly deal with, but again, the consequences of it are something that we all have to face. And today, what's today, the 28th of June? If you start from 12 midnight last night to 12 midnight tonight, the population of the Earth will have increased by about 210,000 people. That's the size of Des Moines. That's not 210,000 births. That's 210,000 births more than there are deaths. And it's a lot of people. Minnesota's population is just under 5 million, 4.7 or 4.8 million people in Minnesota right now. The world's population will grow by that 4.8 million people within 23 days from now. It's growing fast, very fast. If you look at human history and how our population has exploded, it took until somewhere in the mid-1800s before we reached the first billion people. All of ancient civilization through to the 1800s, we reached 1 billion people. Then the exponential curve, and a lot of this had to do with, not because people were giving birth to more children, but because people were living longer and healthier and more people were able to give birth to more children. And it took until 1930 we reached 2 billion. I think it was, well, it was October of 99 when we reached 6 billion. And in some ways population growth has been slowing down somewhat, but they still project we'll reach the 7 billionth person by the year 2013. So we have about 12 more years to reach 7 billion people. And if we were to stop having 3 kids or whatever we're having per couple, if we were to make a level population, stable thing, where you assume every woman of childbearing age or every woman will give birth to 2 children, women are half the population, presumably every 2 people would produce 2 more people, we'd have sustainable population. We'd have a level population, but not right away. There are a whole lot more people who were born last year than were born 51 years ago. And because the older age levels are less populated, not only because people die off in the course of the older you get, the more chance of dying, but also because so many more are born. And if we were to have just replacement populations, so every woman who is under or goes through child, or from now on, every woman born would give birth to 2 children on average, it would take us another 60 or 70 years until we reached the maximum population the Earth would, where it would level off, and the population estimates are as much as 12 or 13 billion people before that happens. So it is an explosion. All of human history, to 1800s for 1 billion, and just over a century to reach 6 billion, and now, again, we could double that again in the next 60 or 70 years if we cut it down to 2 people per 2 adults. Why be concerned about this? Well, I think it's fairly obvious. I mean, how you can get to issues that we notice here in the United States, urban sprawl, traffic congestion, I know is a big growing issue in the Twin Cities area, waste disposal. Again, these are where you get to the issues that in the state legislature we start dealing with. I remember 5 or 6 years ago talking about the landfills in the metropolitan area of the Twin Cities, meaning within like 40, 50 miles. I think there were like 6 remaining with capacity in them that had been licensed in the lined landfills that are now legal, the only things legal. There hasn't been a new one cited in those 10, 15 years. And the capacity of them will be filled up, in their estimates are, another 10, 15 years. We already haul waste. Remember the garbage barge that was couldn't find a home several years ago? Already a lot of waste crossing state lines because Minnesota has tighter environmental standards for the waste dumps. They have to be lined landfills and so on. Some of the waste haulers haul their waste to Iowa and Wisconsin, which I'm sure the people of Iowa and Wisconsin are not fully aware of in general and probably aren't fond of the concept, but they are taking it. And a lot of states in the Northeast have to go quite a ways to haul trash. But waste disposal, despite growing efforts to recycle, which have been successful, we still generate far, far more waste than we did 20 years ago. When you used to grow your things, and if you're making tomato soup, you'd grow your tomatoes and you'd make your own soup and you didn't have any packaging. Then you get the can of Campbell's condensed soup and you make that. That was the next stage. And now you buy these little cup of soup things in a plastic wrapper that comes with this, and there's more plastic than there is soup. Yes?
I just heard the other day, Roy Sapti was telling me that his daughter-in-law works with waste in eastern North Dakota, and she works with waste in a 17-county area, and was involved with this study, and they determined that there was more waste from one day at the Mall of America than in the 17-county area.
Wow. And you look at,
the same length of time.
The Mall of America has, again, food courts that are, again, fast food, which people, I mean, fast food sort of started in my lifetime. I remember we used to go to the second McDonald's ever, and where Hamburger U is now, and they started those about the time I was born in fast food. Just think how much, on the way out here, we stopped at a fast food place, and I think there was as much trash, obviously could be compacted, but it seems to be, it's an awful lot of garbage for one meal. And we are, despite our efforts at recycling, we are producing far more trash. And as the population grows, if the U.S. population, again, I'm not sure exactly, 285 million people now, that takes, Roger, you said you remember when it was 180 or 100?
It was around 160, I think. That was 58.
Yeah, and it's the 160, 180 million people produce less waste on a, just because of the sheer smaller numbers than 280 some million do. And given the fact that I think the per capita waste generated is many times per person what it was back then, we've obviously got a growing problem, not a shrinking one. And that's just the waste disposal, energy consumption, global warming. And some of these things do take care of themselves. I remember 25 years ago, they talked about oil consumption and how long we, at the projected level of growth, how long we could continue to have oil supplies. And they said maybe 40, 50 years, tops. Well, consumption has continued to grow as it had then, but we've been able to find more sources of oil, deeper reserves than we thought. And so the projections do get extended out there, but the more fossil fuels we consume, the more global warming problems we have. So we're having all those kind of environmental problems, deforestation, et cetera. Go ahead.
So many things are voluntary, and I know that we honor and really relish freedoms, but sometimes the freedoms come without the responsibility. And so then, in order to stop this, you know, waste and other things, should things be mandatory?
That's a good question, and I mean, a whole lot of this discussion, I think, will evolve around that. It seemed to me the first thing we might want to do is at least get to some of the voluntary things. And when you're talking about population, getting into mandatory things, it'll be touchy, but we'll get to that some more too. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, one of the things that, especially in this country, is very true, is we're not paying the true cost.
Right.
Because the cost of that McDonald's meal should include the cost of the disposal of the trash. The cost of the gasoline we pay is significantly, and the privilege to drive on the roads is significantly subsidized by the government. The companies are rewarded, they will do exactly what they're incentivized to do.
Right, you need to be incentives to change.
I mean, I'm a chemical engineer, I've done extensive work in that industry, and I'm given the regulation and said, we can run cleaner than this, but run right to the limit, because that's what we're permitted for, we're gonna go right for that. So I turn around and say, how can I get more barrels through so you don't put more out?
Yeah. I was going to say, I think I appreciate these statistics, which are depressing at best. And I think what I, as just an onlooker, see is there's no acknowledgement that it really does have an impact. I mean, what I read is there will be a study which will be out in 6 years whether the CO2 emissions has an effect.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's interesting that when government discussions of how to deal with these policies come up, such as the global warming one, there is always somebody who's opposed to restrictions on something. Certain industries that produce global warming gases, they oppose it, and what can they do? They can find some scientist somewhere who will say it's not really a problem, or it's way overblown as a problem. I think the scientific community seems to be pretty united that we've got a problem and we may not know how serious the problem is. And yes, we're not acknowledging these problems exist. And I think the point here about the, some have called life cycle costing of how much you pay to do it. In our utility industry, and the issues we have in Minnesota are similar to the ones in Washington State and everywhere else. Last week there was a guy from Hanford Nuclear Waste Dump in Washington, and we had a forum discussing that waste dump. And as the pressure is, we have to clean up the mess from the last 50 years, mainly nuclear weapons production waste, 53 million gallons of the high-level radioactive waste that's in tanks that a third or fourth of them have been leaking already, and how long does it go till that gets to the Columbia River? We've acknowledged there's a problem, but the government isn't even addressing it on the scale. I think he said if they got the funding they needed, they could have cleaned up the existing mess within 40 years, and they're not funding that, and when does it start leaking? We're not paying for that, and yet the push now, his biggest concern is that we're moving ahead now with more nuclear power production with no clue what we're going to do with the waste. Again, that gets back to the point.
And
you don't factor those costs in.
I don't think you'd expect the government to come in and clean it up, because the technology to produce it, the people who are doing that probably have the best handle on what it takes to remediate.
And there's no incentive for the government to clean it up until the public political pressure gets so strong that people have to do it. And basically people who live downriver in the Columbia River stream are going to, well, it may not be their problem, it may be their grandkids' problem. We don't know when the problem occurs, but at some point we've got much bigger cleanup costs to deal with. And I think your comments about how much of the things waste generation, a lot of these problems are because we don't factor in the total cost, the environmental cost. So when the administration in Washington says nuclear power is part of the answer to California's problems, yeah, if we don't factor in the disposal cost because we don't have a clue how we're going to do it, then it becomes cheaper. If you factor in all the global costs of it, the environmental costs, the cleanup costs, you have higher costs, and maybe we wouldn't be driving as big a cars as we're driving. But all of these issues are ones that that I think we ought to be aware of. And while some of them, when you get into the you described as horror or frightening, the numbers, certainly we do have some things where we make progress. Perhaps the biggest shortage issue in the next 20, 30 years could well be, if I had to guess, I'd say water, fresh water supplies. A lot of conflicts have been fought over oil and other resources. The Israeli-Palestinian issue is already heating up more and more over fresh water. And the Israeli settlements in the Palestinian territories are they're taking the good water. And those things certainly heat up a conflict like that. And as more people come to more places and we have shortages of water, that could frighten. It's frightening the consequences, but again, we may have new, cheaper ways of desalinization of water to get fresh water out of salt water, and maybe we can take care of those problems. There is technology that addresses some of this and makes it a little less scary. I mean, the response to people who don't want to deal with these things say, oh, technology will take care of everything. And they'll give the examples with waste. Well, New York City, if automobiles hadn't been invented, it would be 150 feet deep in horse manure by now. Of course, technology changes things, but each time we're creating answers to some things, we are creating more of the waste, more of the problems. And with the environmental shortages, the shortages of resources, whether they're fossil fuels or whether it's water or whatever, we ought to be talking about it. So why don't we talk about it? Well, a couple of reasons. One, there's no political pressure to do so. And the system is much more, American politics at least, is much more responsive to pressure or to crises rather than proactive prevention measures.
Yeah. Indeed, if you push on the political envelope, you then quickly get into abortion issues, right to life conflicts, and religious conflicts, especially if you take a Catholic perspective and the Catholic Church stance on contraception. So if you push that political envelope, it's subject to fall apart quickly.
Yes, I was going to say that. That in addition to failing to address crises, this one has the negative thing that you get involved. In Minnesota this year, family planning grants, when I left there, there still had been unresolved because there was a big dispute. We don't want to give family planning grants to anyone who has anything to do with, if the word abortion is ever mentioned, a mean, abortion has been tied up in just about every nursing home funding bill this year is tied up in abortion politics. Every single issue is being tied up in things that don't even relate to healthcare nowadays. And certainly family planning is a key one. Congress, every time they get to family planning funds for other countries, it's tied up in abortion debate.
Are there some residents in nursing homes that are using abortion?
It could be. No, it's just a matter of it's the funding bill for it, and therefore they want to, well,
get a rider.
It's, they put in little riders there if you try and pass a bill anywhere you can, and but certainly it becomes a sensitive topic because of not just the abortion issue, but that's one of the key things that happens in Congress. And so again, the crisis response. Well, what do we do about it? I mean, what are the responses? Well, the interesting thing, I wrote a column on this issue a while back, and I cited some group that was working in trying to educate people about this, and later on I heard some more stuff from this guy, and I thought, well, I don't want to be affiliated with that, because they were it drives out a whole lot of negative responses, too. I got to go through some of them. But one of them, and the one that this individual group had been doing, was anti-immigration. They wanted to say, you know, Americans consume far more per capita of our natural resources and everything else, therefore we ought to shut our doors to any kind of immigration whatsoever. And leave it the rest of the world's problem. And a few years ago, even Sierra Club had a debate because some of their members said, well, we're going to destroy America's natural resources if we have too many people. And so rather than address it any other way, let's stop all immigration. And that was, I think it was a fairly small minority of them, but nevertheless, there is the use, let's use population concerns as an argument against immigration, which I guess I have some strong concerns about. But that's only the tip of the iceberg in terms of how population control issues become, I guess, sort of self-centered responses, what's good for me and who cares about the rest of the world. When I was in college, there was a biologist who decided he was going to get involved in ethics, and a guy named Garrett Hardin, who wrote about what he called lifeboat ethics. And he painted a picture of the world as being a big sea of humanity. And this is, again, when the population of the world was more like 4 billion than the 6 billion that we are at least living with and surviving with, and projected, as I said, to keep growing faster. But with about 4 billion people, he concluded that we were way overpopulated, and that the only way we could respond was not by helping others, but to decide we're in a lifeboat. Developed nations who have, like the United States, they have enough money and enough food and enough everything else to go around, were like we were in a lifeboat. And if we start reaching out and helping hands to other countries, we're going to just be pulling more people in the lifeboat until it can't sustain itself, and we're all going to sink and we're going to all drown, and we better stop doing that. Instead, he took the approach, you know, it's a shame, but sort of the Ebenezer Scrooge, if they're poor and they don't like the workhouses, let them die and kill off the surplus population. And which I think was a bad social science, among other things. We don't, very, very few societies in human history have ever controlled population when they have no sense of economic security. One of the arguments I've always heard on why that is that in poor countries, your social security is your kids. If you figure some of your kids are gonna die at childbirth, and some of them are gonna die in childhood, and some of them are gonna not be very healthy or disease and other things, you need a lot of kids so that they can support you in your old age, which may be 35, 40, 50 years old, but you need somebody to support you. Nobody else is going to, so you need a lot of kids.
And in addition to that, you need male children.
You need
male children.
Male children who can work harder and bring more income in under our world systems of the way we treat people. And so you don't have a situation where by letting people starve, you somehow decrease the population. But Hardin, I think it was, he had other problems too. I mean, as if we have a wall around our country and all of a sudden we let the rest of the world starve and we're gonna just live nicely in our own little lifeboat, that there might not be wars and other problems over that, terrorism, whatever. But he assumed that this was all a well, nice thing to do, and I was gonna say, I remember reading a very nice story, I don't know whether it was in The Other Side or Sojourners or something, but some guy who, fictional story of a guy who read about the lifeboat ethics, and he thought, you know, the Christian response is, I better hop out of the lifeboat and let somebody else in my place. And so he started wearing the same clothes year after year, say day after day. He sold everything he had and kept his job, but was getting thinner and thinner. And they asked him how much he was eating. Well, he, like 600 calories a day or something. His boss said, you're starving yourself. And he said, well, that's what a lot of people in the world live on. And I figured if it was a Christian, I gotta share it with that. I was gonna say, that's probably, if the lifeboat ethics was a realistic human scenario of where we stand, realistic scientific description of where we are, the Christian response is not to push other people off the boat, but to join them. But aside from, I think Garrett Hardin's theories kind of went away in times because, one, it was awfully cruel and hard-hearted, and two, it wasn't accurate, and three, population kept growing and it didn't, what he suggested would come to pass didn't really come to pass. But the other negative responses, I mean, you get to China where, I don't know, somebody's, your comment was about the mandatory versus voluntary efforts of doing it. Well, China has decided, is the world's biggest population, I think they're like 1.2 billion people, fifth of all humanity. And they've been working for a number of years to make sure they don't keep growing in number. They can't handle all the people. And I always like to suggest we're trying to, I think they say you can count to a million if you're counting like dollar bills at one, two, three. Take you about 3 days to count to a million if you count 24 hours a day. A billion, 1,000 times that, 3,000 days, that's, what is it, 8 years? 8 years of one, two, three, that speed of counting to get to a billion. China's got 1.2 billion people. And they've gone way, I think a lot of people would be horrified at. Mandatory policy, I think it's one child per couple, forced sterilization, forced abortion. And what's it lead to? It leads to a lot of, as you mentioned, the desire to have male children because they are economically worth more. Worth more in quotes. There's a lot of, allegedly, there's infanticide of, if you want a boy and you have a girl, you kill the child. It's pretty crude and inhumane way of dealing with it. And I don't know that it's highly successful. I keep hearing China's population is continuing to grow, and I assume people are hiding children other ways to get around it. But the point is that there are lots of very crude things and self-centered things, and what's good for me, what's good for our community, not what's good for humanity, that come out of the response to talking about population. So even if we are concerned about it, want to have a humane way of doing it, it always brings out some people who have these very nasty ideas. And I'm surprised we haven't heard more about it, but maybe it's because nobody's talking about population at all. But the AIDS epidemic, which has actually had a major impact on population in certain African countries, that somebody's going to go out there and suggest the AIDS epidemic is a good thing because of that. I mean, some of you watched the movie the other day, and
God's will.
Yeah, God's will somehow. And this Reverend Phelps from Kansas who goes out with this hate stuff, you know, that some people that age is gonna, whatever. I mean, there's sick people out there who who, when you talk about population, they're going to come out of the woodwork too. Well, what are the real solutions? What should we be talking about doing? Because of the idea of people using children for their own economic security, I was going to suggest that one of the best things we can do in the countries that have brought population under control have been economic security countries where people have a chance to ensure their own economic security, is that we have to find a way to provide the social security. That's not necessarily the United States government's responsibility or us as a country's responsibility, but we have to work. We're all in this, we're all on this planet together. We all consume the planet's resources together, and we have a clear incentive to help address this, and somehow or another making it so that people are able to support themselves without having more children seems to be a key thing that we have to find a way to do. You can't tell somebody, well, for the good of the planet, don't have more kids, when they need it for their own economic security. The second one, which somebody here mentioned the politics of it, the whole concept of family planning, birth control, and contraception, again, as opposed to the Chinese model, the voluntary model, which I think 99.9% of Americans would say it, these ought to be voluntary things. We don't even provide funding for them in our own country to the level where people need them. And again, the issue of abortion tied in with that is one of the main ones. Health insurance companies, a lot of states mandate some of this, and most of it now, I think there have been some court cases requiring it to happen, but there's a lot slower progress in making sure health plans were going to cover birth control and contraception. Then Viagra comes on the market and it's covered immediately.
That's where Washington Bartell employee came in this last month.
Oh.
Yeah.
Read that in the news.
Yeah.
She was given a
vote. Yeah, that's right, the court cases. Yeah. And the point is, even private insurance has been hesitant to do that. I'm not sure why. I was going to believe that economically for a health plan, it would be cheaper to provide the contraception rather than pay the cost of childbirth, but maybe the thinking is that if women of childbearing age tend to be very costly for health plans, maybe they figure if we don't provide contraception and so on, maybe they'll go to other health plans. But
simpler than that, the health plans are run by men. And
that's probably a good part of the reason. But whatever, we have not, health plans have not always provided. I think because of some of those court cases, it's going to change. Certainly, the abortion politics that somebody mentioned clearly tie it up. And with that, while the Catholic Church's official teachings on birth control are, I don't know, I haven't heard the Catholic Church talking about that in recent years at all, but, and they say something like 80 some percent of American Catholics don't follow it, and that's not surprising, but it is still a controversial issue with small numbers of people for religious beliefs who object to it. And then finally, I'd argue that aside from the abortion and family planning being controversial because of that, there's also the whole fear of talking about sexuality. TV shows, every now and then somebody does an analysis of TV shows and how many times they talk about, they illustrate or imply sexual intercourse and how many times they talk about birth control. And it's like one in 40 episodes or so where they will talk about somebody using pregnancy prevention. We're scared to talk about this issue, so we don't talk about it as a society, and therefore we have a lot of people having unplanned pregnancies in our country, showing that if it's hard to deal with other countries, it should be at least a little easier here, but we have a lot of trouble and we don't do a good job of it. Well, outside of the family planning and the economic security, I'd suggest another key part of it is the education, and two parts of this. One is the sexual education, family planning education on the importance of that and the availability of that. And the other part of it is over the part of global population and environmental issues, because a lot of people, I think when we were having children, a lot of the previous generation, it was very common to have 6, 8, 10 children. Certain religious groups, Catholics, tended to have the larger families, but it wasn't uncommon. My grandparents, I think of my four grandparents, one of them was one of about 11 siblings, another one about 10, and another one I think may have had 12. Very large families, and some of that is people saying, what's a responsible number of children to have? And so discussion of this, just plain education about global population and about family planning, aside from educating people that family planning resources and contraceptives are out there, just the simple concept of talking about global population makes people say, how many children do we want to have?
You know, a point that just really hit home when you said that. I think what has to happen for me is it has to come down to, what does this mean for me? What is the cause? I have to find a cause and effect. Otherwise, my day-to-day life, I'll zip to the McDonald's, I'll consume, I'll just, accumulate. It has to come down to a personal level, I think.
Do you mean with that, with this issue of the number of children?
Even just consumption, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But I think even family planning, what strikes me is an advertisement. I'm sure you've maybe seen the billboard or the TV commercial with it's a Hispanic-looking woman. And there's two scenes. It's sort of a split scene. One is family planning, and she has a baby at her breast, and she's cheery, and she's cuddling and caressing this infant. And the other one is not family planning, and she's haggard, and her shirt is kind of like dragging, and she looks like she's going to go over the edge. It was an image that has stuck in my mind when you see family planning. It's choice versus sort of a destructive downward spiral for a woman responsible for caring for a child.
Who would put an ad like that in?
What's that?
Yeah, who put out that ad?
I don't know. Has anybody else seen that?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Is that in Washington or
it's on TV, I think, and then the scene, there's no planning, she's got a baby at the breast of about a 3-year-old and about a 1-year-old, and they're all crying.
Yeah.
The mother's going,
Well, just that kind of thing brought a message home to me.
Yeah.
What's the outcome here?
And clearly with teenagers, I've seen a number of ads with teenagers saying about how I really love my baby, I really wanted my baby, but it would have been nice if I finished school first, and again, just showing the consequences of it. I think you're right, showing the personal connection to it. But in terms of the idea that discussion of global population and so on, you think?
It does to me.
Yeah.
But it doesn't to me when I think about my own personal life. Let's walk, let's turn off the TV, let's take it to a personal level in the neighborhood. In my own day-to-day life, when I'm traveling, awareness, that's where I start to make changes. I compost, I walk, I turn off lights when it becomes for me, the global, the political, because I'm not a politician, it doesn't hit home to me, it doesn't make me want to change
But it's, again, I was going to say, most people when they're thinking population, they're not thinking politics. And obviously some change in society, and I at least think some of it may be the discussion in the 70s, early 70s about population explosion, that the next generation of parents having kids tended to have 1 to 3 kids rather than maybe 1 to 4 rather than 3 to 7. That there was a downsizing of that of families because of some concern, we don't want to have too many children. I don't know, and maybe the newer generation who wasn't of age to listen to that in the early 70s, maybe it's back to what's wrong with having 10 kids. Connie had a classmate in college whose goal was to have 12 kids. She didn't. I was going to say that would be, it's an unusual goal now. I don't think I hear a lot of people saying our goal is to have a very large family. Some through adoption do, and some through birth do. But I don't know. Are others hearing other things? Is there a sense of this?
I live in an unusual place. I have where the Mormon culture is so very much in large families, and it's part of the theology, much less the culture. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's one.
The other thing is, for instance, in Italy and Spain, their birth rate is almost zero, and they are having terrible problems keeping with younger people. And as the population ages, they don't have the young people coming up to support. So they have a population explosion in China, but in Western Europe, at least in those two countries, you have not enough kids, and they're importing. So, you know, it's not...
Well, I don't think you're going to find a way to, I mean, when you're dealing with something in a voluntary manner, you're not going to have that. And cultural differences, I was going to say, between the Mormon culture and non-Mormon, Lutheran culture, for instance. But I was going to say, I think in the biggest family size change I've noticed since I was a little child was the Catholic families, about the number of kids they used to have compared to now. I guess I'm curious, does anybody else have any thoughts of whether your point is right, that it's, you don't compost though because it's good for your family, you compost presumably because it's good for the environment. I would care to bet that at least some of this downsizing of family is due to some of the discussion about global population. I'm curious
for the cost of college.
I was going to say
economics.
A lot of it comes down to money.
When they have the estimates $250,000 to $280,000 to raise a kid.
I would say that it's, I'd be very surprised if anything would come close to the reason being economics. Yeah. And the reason why, other than cultural, very, you know, limited, I think, cultural exceptions, lots of kids you need to in a lot of third world countries, but at least in any place that I've been, it's an economic decision to have less children. And frankly, even anecdotally, families who have more children, there's the kind of cluck, cluck, my goodness, you know, that's not very smart economically. Mm-hmm. In terms of child care, college, you name it. And so it seems to me, if we're talking about solutions, political solutions, economic justice is a part of the picture.
Though it's interesting, because I think you're right about that being a key factor in a lot of families, because it is, again, I think a lot of you probably saw the numbers recently, I don't remember what it was, but not counting college costs, how much it is to raise a child. It was well over $250,000 per child now. But the reason I was going to say I'm not sure how many families that's the factor is because a whole lot of the low-income families who are struggling. I mean, I see a lot of people who, some of them recent immigrants, who simply can't afford it, and they're working. One family, our church resettled 20 years ago, Hmong family. The mom works two jobs, the dad works one. They have like seven or eight kids. They're actually doing pretty well, but still, the economic thing, I was just curious, but you'd say that seems to be a consensus that that's probably the main reason?
I think the economic thing comes in when there's also, when the parents have a very high level of education, because they will project out before they even consider having kids, they will project out, okay, what's this going to do to, how can we plan out the college, how can we plan out the retirement, how can we do these things and provide what they want to provide for their children,
right,
that type of thing. And that comes with a lot of financial stability early on to start with, to be able to have the time to have that discussion, and then also a level of education to the point where those abstractions are realized completely.
Yeah, that might help explain, because I mean, that because it's almost backwards from the way you'd expect it to be, but the families who are financially more secure are the ones who are doing more thinking about the economic costs of it. And that might be about bringing in your point about showing, if you want to reduce population, showing the cost of it and letting people think ahead of time about it.
That's one of the things in Cedar's book that he says that the single key to population tailoring seems to be the education of women in third world and underprivileged countries, because once they see they can be more than just a reproduction factor,
right,
then
this morning's Bible study, Kristen Lee was talking about all the wives and all the Rachel and Leah and their maids who, you know, how many children they all produced and so on. Yeah, when the concept is that your purpose is to be reproducing. Again, the whole education concept of what's acceptable. And I was going to say, part of that education thing is the attitude changing. In some countries it may be, in some places here it may be, that you can do more than this, that there are alternatives to just having children. And the other one is, and I think I hear this from a small number of people, and maybe it's a religious thing that certain religious groups have, but it's almost the sense that, well, we love children, so we're going to have more of them. As if somehow if you have 1 to 3 children, you don't love them as much as if you have 4 to 6 children. I mean, I don't know that that's ever been true, that you love children, so you got to have more of them. But there is, at least with a small group of people, that there's that sort of concept. And so I think that it's a whole range of education and changing things. What are other, I guess I wanted to just sort of open it up totally. Gertrude.
Well, where Dean and I live, they have a rebuilding Planned Parenthood. There's been such opposition against it. So the ones that are against abortion are determined to build a building right next to it to prevent it. And you think, well, while they protest, they never are the ones that volunteer to take care of the children who are born drug addicts, you know, who have special health problems, mm-hmm. deformities, and so on. You know, all they think about is have kids.
The abortion, yeah.
But if they're going to protest, then there should be a purpose behind it, I think. There's a responsibility.
I was going to say that Planned Parenthood in, I think in North Dakota, I don't know if there are North Dakotans here, but I think there was one clinic in Fargo that closed a year ago or so. I don't know if there, I mean, Planned Parenthood offices, Minnesota is the Planned Parenthood for the Dakotas in Minnesota. It's not like there are a lot of alternative groups out there who provide birth control family planning. There aren't a lot, and the abortion politics are making it extremely difficult for them to provide the services. This isn't meant to be a talk about abortion, but it certainly does end up tying in there. I've always argued that when you're dealing with the abortion issue, both sides of it should be in favor of family planning. Other than a small number of people who, for religious purposes, believe any sort of contraception is immoral or wrong. Other than that, which is a very small percentage of certain religious groups that believe that, everybody else, it should be in the same thing. The more we can do to prevent the unwanted pregnancies, the better off we're going to be in reducing the number of abortions. But it doesn't work that way. In politics, no, the abortion issue tends to be, and there are exceptions, but it tends to be the same groups that are anti legal abortion are also anti-funding for any kind of social services that might be wrong. Yes.
Sean, I wanted to ask you about the politics of discussion about these kind of issues. What kind of restraints or constraints you feel, you know, the political rhetoric is under? The problems we're talking about are global problems, or international problems, and they're being solved, you know, domestically.
Right.
And yet there seems to be an unwillingness, if the best word on it, to talk about genuinely cooperative international efforts on the part of, well, agriculture, resource management, those kinds of things. What kind of creative language is possible?
Well, I was going to say the constraints, I think we several people pointed out, the abortion-related ones, and the main thing I would suggest is there seems to be no political capital in doing something about it or in even raising the issue. It's the kind of issue that you'd picture if there was any political capital in it, some presidential candidate would start talking about, you know, this is a real problem.
It's an easy target if somebody cared about it.
Yeah, and it's this, there's the sense, I think, in politics that there's no plus to talking about it. Even raising the issue, and again, there is definitely the negatives that, oh, then you're going to bring in this whole other range of issues. And again, it's the biggest thing is not, I would sense, and this is my sense, I can speak for myself, not for others, but my sense is that in the political world, it's not necessarily that people are, oh, I'm so scared to talk about population because of this, or there's no benefit to talking about it, but it's simply a matter of politics and modern society. We don't proactively think about things. We don't try and prevention. Your whole concept about the entire cost of a product. We look at the short term, what do we do now, and we don't think about what happens. I've always described the long-term thinking in politics as the next election. If it's 2 years off, that's what long-term thinking is. We don't think. I mean, I would say whenever you have somebody in politics giving a talk on long-term thinking, they're thinking maybe 10 years down the road, 20 years down the road, three generations down the road. I mean, it's not on anybody's radar screen. That's why I like talking about these nuclear waste storage issues, 10,000 year half-life or something. 10,000 years ago, that's pre-Egyptian high civilization. We don't know what was going on then. Think of what's happened to the world in that 10,000 years. How will we take care of something 10,000 years now? That's inconceivable, even 100 years down the road. I don't think you're going to hear any political debate in the next year from any candidate at any level talking, what about 100 years from now?
What do we do? What do I do when I hear the Kyoto Agreement was just sort of vague and I can't really respond to that? I mean, what do I do?
How do you make these things happen?
Jane Doe, in Seattle. What can I do? Because it frightens me.
Aren't we kind of lazy? I mean, the man on the street or the woman on the street, I mean, we work, go home to our little cubicle, and we don't want to be bothered by some of these
unpleasant and...
Well, we're also very cynical about the capacity of political solutions for these very huge problems.
Yeah.
If the political system if the legislative system incentivizes something, that's exactly what you get. And unfortunately, by the time a regulation gets through legislation, the technology, and having people who don't have the PhDs and things like that, writing engineering spec, you don't get the right solution.
I was going to say that I think, I don't know if I characterize it as laziness because people are, maybe because we have a lot more leisure time than we have in the past, we're still busier than ever. I mean, people talk all the time how busy everybody is. We overload ourselves, sensory overload from, somebody mentioned today they enjoyed not having any billboards or advertisements while they're here at Holden, and we quickly get used to life here and then we go back and may not think about it, but that's just the world out there. How does anybody get your attention now? You gotta really blast away because there's so many ways of hitting people's attention. And so we're busy.
Depends on us, though.
What?
Change depends
on
us, though.
That's why her question of how do we get people involved, I wouldn't say it's so much laziness, it's just busyness, and we have to prioritize and we have to be involved. I was gonna say there's several groups you can contact. Zero Population Growth, I think, is one of the oldest ones. ZPG.org. And I for something I was writing a year ago on this thing, I found a cute one that was about the 6 billion people. They had one for kids that gave some good information. It was called dayof6billion.org. Several groups like that, and there are plenty of other groups too that are working in education, trying to get people involved in political action on the issue. And the main thing is, the frustration and I think the cynicism that's out there that the political system isn't going to respond. In a country of 280 some million people, I raise an issue and I try and speak out and do whatever I can on the issue. Is it going to change things? No. It's I doing it and you doing it and we doing it. Everybody trying their little bit. We gradually change the, make it an issue. Say, we want to hear about this. How recently have you seen any letter to the editor on this issue? There are ways that we can do it. I was going to say that these organizations have been working on it. We don't need more organizations to deal with it. We just have to link up with them somehow or another.
Lately in the Seattle Times, a few people have said they're going to send their little gift from Bush to the Planned Parenthood funding that they cut out.
So the federal rebate check. And, yeah, in Minnesota, that's not, I think people, because we're having state rebates too, and our it's interesting because the abortion funding thing has gotten, it's been about the hottest issue, the single hottest issue about half of recent years, and this year it's, we don't want the family planning grants that are going out through the counties to be dispersed to any nonprofit that has any affiliation any way with abortion services or even referrals. So if you even mention abortion, you can't have it. And the counties, so they're proposing that it had to go to the counties, and the counties had to run the family planning thing. So don't let the nonprofits do it, have the government offices do it. Counties are having a fit saying, we don't know how to do this. And then you're gonna get even bigger politics, because you mean the county or the city or the school district is going to be talking about sexuality? But again, that's a big fight, and I'm sure that that's, I'm glad to see the letters the editor talking about it. Gertrude, do you?
Well, I have a daughter that lives in Sweden, and people complain about the taxes. I mean, they're terrific. But with that big tax, they guarantee that old people and children will be taken care of. So it remains very high. It doesn't mean the country's perfect by any means. I mean, you have plenty of problems too. But you know that your parents are taken care of, and children, I mean, they keep track of their doctor's appointments, you get notices when they're new, take them out of school, you do this over there, which is a big safety net for those kids and the elderly. The criticism is, oh, my parents are being taken care of by through our taxes, I don't have to go and visit them anymore.
Yeah.
That's not good either.
Yeah, you want to keep the responsibility out there without,
right. Yeah. But I think the idea of the taxes taking care of the young and the old is important.
And it's probably why they have a lot longer life expectancy than we do.
They know where the taxes are going. We don't know where our taxes are going.
Paul?
I personally belong to a bunch of environmental groups, CPG, Environmental Defense Fund, Natural Resources Defense Council, and all the time now on the internet, they send out letters that you can just kind of adjust a little bit, sign it and send it in. And so, when the Kyoto Treaty came, they have a letter put out by abortion, and on and on it goes. My question is, as a politician, are those things, I do it all the time, but I kind of cynically wonder, do they pay attention to this? Do they care that I'm doing that? That was the other
very
class.
Good question.
Yeah, I had a class on that a couple of days ago, but it is a good question. How do you do it? I was going to say, I don't know if any of those groups suggest the same thing in terms of writing letters to the editor. And there's only so much letters to the editor space you can get and so on, but a lot of local papers, small weekly papers that print a lot of what they get. And I know some people in some smaller Minnesota communities that have, they may be the regular letter writers who every month or so they seem to have a letter in the papers. And I was going to say that we have to find a way to raise the visibility of issues like this, and one of the ways to do that is raising public awareness, not just contacting the elected officials. Yes, it's worthwhile writing the elected officials. You're going to have more success at state and local issues that way, because there are fewer people and less mail they're getting. At the presidential level, I was going to guess it probably doesn't have a major impact. Bush's policies are being set, he and his advisors are setting policies not based on, oh, we got 300,000 cards on this issue as opposed to a few years ago, we only got 100,000. I don't think, I was going to say at the presidential level, I'd say it's a very, very unlikely thing to have a major impact. But getting it so there's discussion in the public where they're, you start raising the issue, I think you'd have more luck per letter written. And again, certainly at the state level, which doesn't help a lot with population.
Well, these are usually to the senator, or, you know, mm-hmm. they're singled out, your senator, your representative, yeah. and then they go to them. That's my question.
It's certainly better to, yeah, the more contact you can have, the better. The more personal, the dear senator fill in the blank tends to be less absorbed, less paid attention to than that. And the fastest thing you do now is email everybody. But that's also becoming, because of sheer quantity, the more clutter, the more you're competing with, the less your email is going to do. So while it's a lot easier than mailing a letter, it probably doesn't have the same impact.
Do you ever feel that we have to suffer more before we'll get active?
Well, tomorrow I'm going to be talking about New Deal and what I was calling Raw Deal. When times get really tough, people band together and we get more proactive.